Chapter 4. Architecture of Emotional and Psychosomatic Disorders. Part 4.
Like other psychogenic disorders, sexual problems also typically have deeper roots in the transpersonal domain, linking them to various karmic, archetypal, and phylogenetic elements. Erectile dysfunction, impotence, the inability to develop or maintain an erection, and orgastic incompetence, frigidity, the inability to attain an orgasm, have a similar psychodynamic basis. The conventional approach to these problems is reflected in their old names, impotence and frigidity, now considered obsolete and politically incorrect. It sees impotence as a lack of masculine power and sexual weakness. Orgastic incompetence in women, as the name frigidity indicates, is usually interpreted as sexual coldness and a lack of erotic responsiveness. According to my experience, the opposite often seems to be true. It is actually an excess of sexualized perinatal energy that is the problem. Individuals suffering from these disorders are under the strong influence of the sexual aspect of BPM-3. This makes it impossible for them to experience sexual arousal without simultaneously activating all the other elements of this matrix. The intensity of the sexual drive, the aggressive impulses, vital anxiety, and fear of loss of control associated with BPM-3 then inhibit the sexual act. In both instances, the sexual problems are connected with coax systems that, besides the perinatal component, also have biographical layers and transpersonal roots. Personal and karmic memories of sexual abuse, rape, associations between sex and pain or danger, and similar themes. The empirical support for the involvement of perinatal dynamics in impotence and frigidity comes from experiential psychotherapy. When we create a non-sexual situation in which the elements of BPM-3 can be brought into consciousness and the energy associated with them discharged, impotence can be temporarily replaced by a condition called satyriasis, an excessive sexual drive and appetite. This is due to the fact that a connection has been established between the penis and the sexual energy generated by the trauma of birth. It is now this perinatal energy, and not the ordinary libido, that is being expressed in the sexual act. Due to the excessive amount of energy available on the perinatal level, this situation can result in an insatiable appetite and an unusual ability to perform sexually. The men who were not previously able to maintain an erection at all are now capable of having intercourse several times in a single night. The release is usually not fully satisfactory, and as soon as they reach orgasm and ejaculate, the sexual energy starts to build up again. More non-sexual experiential work is necessary to bring this energy to a niveau that can be comfortably handled in a sexual situation. When this condition develops in everyday life, outside of the therapeutic situation, it can persist and manifest as sexual addiction. In a similar way, when women, who were previously unable to attain an orgasm, discharge the excessive energy associated with BPM-3 in a therapeutic situation, they can reach a point where they can now allow the orgasm to happen. When this occurs, the initial orgasms tend to be very intense. They are often accompanied by loud, involuntary screams and are followed by several minutes of violent shaking. There might be a tendency to briefly lose control and bruise or scratch the partner's back. Under these circumstances, it is not uncommon for the woman to experience multiple orgasms. This initial liberation can also lead to an increase of sexual appetite to such a degree that it appears insatiable. We can then see a temporary transformation of frigidity into a condition known as nymphomania. This is characterized by a strong sexual drive and difficulty reaching full release. And again, as in the case of men involved in experiential work for erectile dysfunction, additional inner work in a non-sexual situation is necessary to bring the discharge of perinatal energy to a level where it allows for a more appropriate sexual life. The amount of sexual energy of perinatal origin seems to be particularly large in individuals whose birth was associated with extended periods of suffocation. Over the years, I have worked with many people who were born with the umbilical cord twisted around the neck. A significant number of them reported that they have experienced unusually strong sexual tension all their life, and that they had masturbated excessively in their early childhood. Intense sexual charge generated in situations that involved excessive suffocation might also be an important motivating factor in ischemic sexual practices. There exists a form of orgastic inability where the fear is not connected with the overwhelming nature of the perinatal energy, which is activated by sexual intercourse and threatening to be unleashed, but with involuntary urination. This seems to be a problem occurring exclusively in women because of their much shorter urethra and less effective urinary sphincter. Letting go into a sexual orgasm is withheld and blocked because of the fear that it would be associated with embarrassing involuntary urination. This fear can also present a problem in experiential work with psychedelics or holotropic breathwork. Whenever the process brings the woman to the point of letting go, it manifests as an urge to urinate, and the session is interrupted by going to the bathroom. In the early work with psychedelics, this sometimes happened 10 to 15 times in a single session and made any therapeutic progress impossible. We found, however, a very easy and unconventional solution for this problem. Wearing a diaper or surgical pants and not interrupting the session when the urge occurred. The experience of the contact with warm urine usually brought memories of involuntary urination in childhood, such as episodes of bedwetting or accidents at school. This was usually associated with a mixture of feelings. Shame and embarrassment, but also sensual pleasure. After a few episodes of this kind, the association between sexual letting go and urination was dissolved, and the problem disappeared. The understanding of the perinatal dimensions of sexuality throws an interesting new light on sadomasochism, a condition that represented a formidable challenge for Freud's theoretical speculations. He struggled with it until the end of his life and never really found a satisfactory solution. The active seeking of pain exhibited by masochistic individuals contradicted one of the cornerstones of Freud's early model, the pleasure principle. According to this concept, the deepest motivating force in the psyche was the pursuit of pleasure and avoidance of discomfort. Freud was also baffled by the strange fusion of two basic instincts, sexuality and aggression, that is an essential feature of sadomasochism. It was the existence of sadomasochism and other conditions lying beyond the pleasure principle that forced Freud to abandon his early theories and to create an entirely new system of psychoanalysis that included the controversial thanatos, or death instinct. Although Freud never understood the intimate link between death and birth, which exists on the perinatal level, these late speculations clearly reflected his intuitive insight that sadomasochism borders on matters of life and death. They also reflected Freud's belief that a viable psychological theory had to include the problem of death. This was a radical departure from Freud's early work, when he considered death to be irrelevant for psychology because the id was timeless and did not accept the facts of impermanence and death. Clearly, Freud's thinking in this regard was far ahead of his followers, some of whom formulated theories of sadomasochism that tried to derive this condition from relatively trivial biographical situations. An example of this approach is the work of the Czech psychoanalyst Otakar Kučera, who linked sadomasochism to the experience of teething, when aggressive attempts of the child to bite result in self-inflicted pain. Explanations of this kind do not even begin to account for the intensity and depth of sadomasochistic impulses. Sadomasochism and the bondage syndrome can be understood from the connections that exist in the context of BPM-3 between sexual arousal, physical confinement, aggression, pain, and suffocation. This accounts for the fusion of sexuality with aggression, as well as the link between sexuality and inflicted or experienced pain that characterize these two conditions. The individuals who need to combine sex with such elements as physical restriction, dominance and submission, inflicting and experiencing pain, and strangling or choking are repeating a combination of sensations and emotions that they experience during their birth. The primary focus of these activities is perinatal, not sexual per se. Sadomasochistic experiences and visions are a frequent occurrence in sessions dominated by BPM-3. The need to create a sadomasochistic situation and the unconscious experiential complex mentioned above is not only symptomatic behavior, but also a misguided and truncated attempt of the psyche to expurgate and integrate the original traumatic imprint. The reason why this effort is unsuccessful and does not result in self-healing is the fact that it does not reach deep enough into the unconscious and lacks introspection, insight, and understanding the nature of the process. The experiential complex is acted out without the recognition and awareness of its unconscious sources. The same is true for coprophilia, coprophagia, and urolagnia, sexual deviations characterized by a strong need to bring feces and urine into the sexual situation. Individuals showing these aberrations seek intimate contact with biological materials that are usually considered repulsive. They become sexually aroused by them and tend to incorporate them into their sexual life. In extreme cases, such activities as being urinated or defecated on, smeared with feces, eating excrement, and drinking urine can be a necessary condition for reaching sexual satisfaction. A combination of sexual arousal and scatological elements is a rather common experience during the final stages of the death-rebirth process. This seems to reflect the fact that, in the deliveries where no catheterization or enemas are used, many newborns experience intimate contact not only with blood, mucus, and amniotic fluid, but also with feces and urine. In ancient Rome, where this situation was likely more common, it was characterized by the famous saying, "Inter feces et urinam nascimur." We are born between feces and urine. The natural basis of this seemingly extreme and bizarre deviation is oral contact with feces and urine at the moment when, after many hours of agony and vital threat, the head is released from the firm grip of the birth canal. Intimate contact with such material thus becomes the symbol of a total orgastic release, as well as its necessary prerequisite. According to psychoanalytic literature, the infant, because of his or her essentially animal nature, is originally attracted to various forms of biological material, and only secondarily develops an aversion to them as a result of parental and societal repressive measures. Observations from psychedelic research suggest that this is not necessarily so. The attitude toward biological material is significantly determined by the nature of the encounter with this material during the birth experience. Depending on the specific circumstances, this attitude can be positive or extremely negative. In some deliveries, the child simply encounters vaginal secretions, urine, or feces as part of the ambiance of physical and emotional liberation. In others, this material is inhaled, obstructs the respiratory pathways, and causes terrifying suffocation. In extreme situations of this kind, the life of the newborn has to be saved by intubation and suction that clears the trachea and bronchi and prevents the development of pneumonia. These are two radically different forms of encounter with biological material at birth, one of them positive, the other frightening and traumatic. A situation in which breathing is triggered prematurely and the inhaled biological material threatens the life of the child can generate intense fear and become the basis for a future obsessive-compulsive disorder, as we discussed earlier. Some extreme forms of criminal sexual pathology, such as rape, sadistic murder, and necrophilia, clearly betray perinatal roots. Individuals experiencing the sexual aspects of BPM-3 frequently talk about the fact that this stage of the birth process has many characteristics in common with rape. This comparison makes a lot of sense if one considers some of the essential experiential features of rape. For the victim, it involves serious danger, vital anxiety, extreme pain, physical restraint, a struggle to free oneself, choking, and imposed and enforced sexual arousal. The experience of the rapist, in turn, involves the active counterparts of these activities: endangering, threatening, hurting, restricting, strangling, and enforcing sexual arousal. The experience of the victim has many elements in common with that of the child suffering in the clutches of the birth canal. While the rapist exteriorizes and acts out the introjected forces of the uterine contractions, while simultaneously taking revenge on a mother surrogate. If the memory of BPM-3 is close to consciousness, it can create a strong psychological pressure on the individual to enact its elements in everyday life, to engage in violent consensual sex, or even unconsciously invite dangerous sexual situations. While this mechanism certainly does not apply to all victims of sexual crimes, in some instances it can play an important role. While clearly self-destructive, such behavior contains an unconscious healing impulse. Similar experiences emerging from the subject's own psyche in the context of experiential therapy and with insights into their unconscious sources would lead to healing and psycho-spiritual transformation. Due to this similarity between the experience of rape and the birth experience, the rape victim suffers a psychological trauma that reflects not only the painful impact of the rape situation, but also the breakdown of the defenses protecting her or him against the memory of biological birth. The frequent, long-term emotional problems following rapes are very probably deepened by the emergence into consciousness of perinatal emotions and psychosomatic symptoms. Therapeutic resolution will then need to include work on the trauma of birth. The influence of the third perinatal matrix is even more obvious in the case of sadistic murders, which are closely related to rapes. The dynamics of sadistic murder is closely related to that of bloody suicide. The only difference is that in the former, the individual overtly assumes the role of the aggressor, whereas in the latter, he or she is also the victim. In the last analysis, both roles represent separate aspects of the same personality. The aggressor reflects the introjection of the oppressive and destructive forces of the birth canal, while the victim reflects the memory of the emotions and sensations of the fetus. Psychosomatic manifestations of emotional disorders. Many emotional disorders, such as psychoneuroses, depressions, and functional psychoses, have distinct physical manifestations. Most common among these are headaches, heart palpitations, excessive sweating, tics and tremors, psychosomatic pains, and various skin afflictions. Equally frequent are gastrointestinal disturbances, such as nausea, loss of appetite, constipation, and diarrhea. Among typical concomitants of emotional problems are also various sexual dysfunctions, such as amenorrhea, irregularities of the cycle, menstrual cramps, or painful vaginal spasms during intercourse. We have already discussed erectile dysfunction and the inability to achieve an orgasm. These conditions can either accompany other neurotic problems or occur as independent primary symptoms. In some psychoneuroses, such as conversion hysteria, the physical symptoms are very distinct and characteristic and can represent the predominant feature of the disorder. This is also true for a category of disorders that classical psychoanalysts call pregenital neuroses. It includes various tics, stammering, and psychogenic asthma. These conditions represent hybrids between obsessive-compulsive neurosis and conversion hysteria. The personality structure underlying them is obsessive-compulsive, but the main mechanism of defense and symptom formation is conversion, like in hysteria. There also exists a group of medical disorders in which the role of psychological factors is so significant that even traditional medicine refers to them as psychosomatic diseases. This category includes migraine headaches, functional hypertension, colitis and peptic ulcers, psychogenic asthma, psoriasis, various eczemas, and according to some, even certain forms of arthritis. Mainstream physicians and psychiatrists accept the psychogenic nature of these disorders, but do not offer plausible explanations of the psychogenetic mechanisms involved. Much of the clinical work, theoretical speculations, and research has been based on the ideas of psychoanalyst Franz Alexander, the founder of psychosomatic medicine. Alexander proposed a theoretical model explaining the mechanism of psychosomatic disorders. His key contribution was the recognition that psychosomatic symptoms result from the physiological concomitants of psychological conflict and trauma. According to him, emotional arousal during acute anxiety, grief, or rage gives rise to intense physiological reactions, which lead to the development of psychosomatic symptoms and diseases. Alexander made a distinction between conversion reactions and psychosomatic disorders. In the former, the symptoms have a symbolic significance and serve as a defense against anxiety. This is an important characteristic of psychoneuroses. In psychosomatic disorders, the source of the underlying emotional state can be traced to psychological trauma, neurotic conflicts, and pathological interpersonal relationships. But the symptoms do not serve a useful function. They actually represent a failure of psychological mechanisms to protect the individual against excessive affectual arousal. Alexander emphasized that this somatization of emotions occurs only in those individuals who are predisposed and not in healthy ones. However, neither he nor his successors have been able to define the nature of this disposition. More than six decades later, the situation in the field of psychosomatic medicine is generally very disappointing. It is characterized by a fundamental lack of agreement about the mechanisms involved in the psychogenesis of somatic symptoms, and no conceptual framework is considered entirely satisfactory. The lack of clear answers is responsible for the fact that many authors subscribe to the idea of multi-causality. According to this view, psychological factors play a significant role in psychosomatic disorders, but one has to also take into consideration a variety of other factors, such as constitution, heredity, organ pathology, nutritional status, environment, and social and cultural determinants. These, of course, cannot be adequately specified, which leaves the question of the etiology of psychosomatic disorders open. Psychedelic therapy and holotropic breathwork have brought clear evidence that postnatal psychological traumas in and of themselves are not sufficient to account for the development of emotional disorders. This is also true, even to a much greater extent, for psychosomatic symptoms and disorders. Psychological conflict, loss of an important relationship, excessive dependency, the child's observation of parental intercourse, and other similar factors, which psychoanalysts see as causal factors, simply cannot account for the nature and intensity of the physiological disturbances involved in psychosomatic disorders. In light of deep experiential work, any of the psychoanalytically oriented theories of psychosomatic diseases that try to explain them as based solely on psychological traumas in postnatal biography are superficial and unconvincing. The assumption that these disorders can be effectively treated by verbal therapy is equally implausible. Holotropic research has contributed important insights to the theory and therapy of psychosomatic disorders, but possibly the most important of these findings was the discovery of the enormous amount of blocked emotional and physical energy underlying psychosomatic symptoms. While there can be doubts that psychological biographical traumas could cause deep functional disturbances or even anatomical damage to the organs, this is a reasonable possibility in the case of the elemental destructive energies from the perinatal layer of the unconscious that manifest in holotropic states. In the most general sense, this observation confirmed the concepts of the brilliant and controversial renegade pioneer of psychoanalysis, Wilhelm Reich. On the basis of his observations from therapeutic sessions, Reich concluded that the main factor underlying emotional and psychosomatic disorders is the jamming and blockage of significant amounts of bioenergy in the muscles and viscera, constituting what he referred to as character armor. This, though, is where the parallel between Reichian psychology and the observations from holotropic research ends. According to Reich, this jammed energy is sexual in nature, and the reason for its blockage is a fundamental conflict between our biological needs and the repressive influence of society, which interferes with full orgastic release and a satisfactory sexual life. Residual sexual energy that remains unexpressed then jams and finds deviant expression in the form of perversions and neurotic or psychosomatic symptoms. The work with holotropic states offers a radically different explanation. It shows that the pent-up energy we carry in our organism is not accumulated unexpressed libido, but emotional and physical charge bound in coex systems. Part of this energy belongs to biographical layers of these systems that contain memories of psychological and physical traumas from infancy and childhood. A considerable proportion of this energetic charge, though, is perinatal in origin and reflects the fact that the memory of birth has not been adequately processed. It continues to exist in the unconscious as an emotionally and physically incomplete gestalt of major importance. During delivery, extraordinary amounts of energy are generated by the excessive stimulation of the neurons and cannot be discharged because of the confinement of the birth canal. The reason Reich mistook this energy for jammed libido was probably the strong sexual arousal associated with BPM-3. In some instances, prenatal traumas can significantly contribute to the overall negative charge of the coex systems and participate in the genesis of psychosomatic symptoms. Some people have a very difficult prenatal history that involves such factors as extreme emotional and physical stress of the pregnant mother, impending miscarriage, attempted abortion, toxic womb, or RH incompatibility. The deepest sources of the energy underlying psychosomatic disorders can typically be traced to the transpersonal domain, particularly to karmic and archetypal elements. Of particular interest and importance is the observation from deep experiential work that the primary driving forces behind all psychosomatic manifestations are not psychological traumas. What plays the crucial role in their genesis are unassimilated and unintegrated physical traumas, such as memories of the discomfort associated with childhood diseases, operations, injuries, or near drowning. On a deeper level, the symptoms are related to the trauma of birth and even to physical traumas associated with past life memories. The material underlying psychosomatic pains can include memories of accidents, operations, or diseases from infancy, childhood, and later life. The pain experienced during the birth process and physical suffering connected with injuries or death in a previous incarnation. This is in sharp contrast with the views of most psychodynamic schools that tend to attribute the primary role in the genesis of psychosomatic symptoms to psychological conflicts and traumas. According to them, symptoms originate in such a way that these psychological issues are expressed in symbolic body language or somatized. For example, holding on and getting rid of certain emotions are seen as psychological factors underlying constipation and diarrhea. Severe pain in the neck and shoulders is a symbolic expression of the client carrying too much responsibility on his or her shoulders. Similarly, stomach problems develop in people because they're unable to swallow or stomach something. Hysterical paralysis reflects a defense against an objectionable infantile sexual action. Breathing difficulties are caused by a mother who is smothering the client. Asthma is a cry for the mother, and oppressive feelings on the chest result from heavy grief. In the same vein, stammering is seen as resulting from a suppression of verbal aggression and an urge to utter obscenities, and severe skin disorders serve as protection against sexual temptation. The work with holotropic states provides rich opportunities for insights into the dynamics of psychosomatic disorders. It is actually not uncommon to see the transient occurrence of asthmatic attacks, migraine headaches, various eczemas, and even psoriatic skin eruptions in statu nascendi. That is, as they emerge into manifestation in psychedelic and holotropic breathwork sessions. This is usually associated with insights concerning their psychodynamic roots. On the positive side, dramatic and lasting improvements of various psychosomatic disorders have been reported by therapists and facilitators who use deep experiential techniques in their work. These reports typically describe reliving physical traumas, in particular the birth trauma, and various transpersonal experiences as the most effective therapeutic mechanisms. Space considerations do not allow me to describe in more detail the new insights into the psychodynamics of the specific psychosomatic disorders and offer illustrative case histories. In this regard, I have to refer the interested readers to my earlier publications. Autistic and Symbiotic Infantile Psychoses, Narcissistic Personality, and Borderline States. Pioneers of ego psychology, Margaret Mahler, Otto Kernberg, Heinz Kohut, and others contributed to the classical psychoanalytic classification of several new diagnostic categories that, according to them, have their origin in the early disturbances of object relations. A healthy psychological development proceeds from the autistic and symbiotic stage of primary narcissism through the process of separation and individuation to the attainment of constant object relations. Severe interference with this process and a lack of gratification of basic needs at these early stages can result in serious disorders. According to the degree of these adversities and their timing, these disturbances can lead to autistic and symbiotic infantile psychoses, narcissistic personality disturbance, or borderline personality disorders. The analysis of the disturbances of object relationships underlying these disorders, found in the literature on ego psychology, is unusually detailed and refined. However, like classical psychoanalysts, ego psychologists fail to recognize that postnatal biographical events cannot adequately account for the symptomatology of emotional disorders. Observations from holotropic states suggest that early traumas in infancy have a profound impact on the psychological life of the individual, not only because they happen to a very immature organism and affect the very foundations of personality, but also because they interfere with the recovery from the birth trauma. They leave a connecting bridge and access to the perinatal unconscious wide open. The terms used in ego psychology for describing the postnatal dynamics of these disorders betray their underlying prenatal and perinatal dimensions. The symbiotic gratification, to which ego psychologists attribute great significance, applies not only to the quality of breastfeeding and anaclitic satisfaction in infancy, but also to the quality of the prenatal state. The same is true for the detrimental effects of symbiotic deprivation. As an illustration, here is Margaret Mahler's description of the symbiotic phase. The phase of symbiosis in which the infant behaves and functions as though he and his mother were an omnipotent system, a dual unity within one common boundary, a symbiotic membrane, as it were. Similarly, the regression to autism and to an objectless state has distinct characteristics of a psychological return to the womb, not just to the early postnatal state. Other important aspects of the disorders caused by disturbances in the development of object relations clearly point to perinatal dynamics. Splitting the object world into good and bad, which is characteristic of borderline patients, reflects not just the inconsistency of mothering, good and bad mother, emphasized by ego psychologists. On a deeper level, its source is the fundamental ambiguity of the role that the mother plays in the life of the child, even under the best of circumstances. Prenatally and postnatally, she represents a life-giving and life-sustaining being, while during delivery, she turns into a pain-inflicting and life-threatening antagonist. The children suffering from infantile symbiotic psychosis are described in ego-psychological literature as being caught between the fear of separation and the fear of engulfment. This situation clearly has its source in the trauma of birth, rather than in the transition from primary narcissism to object relations. As we saw earlier, the loss of the womb and the onset of delivery is typically experienced as a life-threatening engulfment. And the transition from BPM-3 to BPM-4 is a terrifying experience of separation. These two experiences are incomparably more powerful than the fear of engulfment or separation experienced in the forming of an object relationship. We should also add that the intensity of rage observed in this category of patients is too great to be of postnatal origin and seems to come from perinatal sources. Psychodynamics of adult psychotic states. In spite of an enormous investment of time, energy, and money into psychiatric research, the nature of the psychotic process has remained a mystery. Extensive systemic studies have explored a wide range of constitutional and genetic factors, hormonal and biochemical changes, biological variables, psychological and social determinants, environmental precipitating influences, and many others. None of these have been sufficiently consistent to provide a convincing explanation of the etiology of functional psychoses. However, even if biological and biochemical research were able to detect processes that show consistent correlation with the occurrence of psychotic states, that would not help us understand the nature and content of psychotic experiences. I have already touched upon this problem in an earlier chapter while discussing laboratory research with LSD. In these experiments, we know the exact composition and dosage of the agent that triggers the experiences, and yet that does not bring clarity into the problem of psychoses. Actually, it made the problem more complex. Instead of bringing a simple answer to the question about the etiology of psychoses, it initiated a grand new project, searching for answers concerning the mystery of the human psyche, of the universe and existence. This research only demonstrated the emergence of deep unconscious material into consciousness. It showed that the potential to create these experiences is clearly an inherent property of the human psyche rather than being a product of a pathological process. The phenomenology of functional psychoses combines perinatal and transpersonal experiences in various ways, with the occasional mixture of postnatal biographical elements. The experiences characteristic of BPM-1 are represented in the symptomatology of psychotic episodes, both in their positive and negative forms. Many patients experience episodes of blissful, symbiotic union with the Great Mother Goddess, and a sense of being nourished in her womb or on her breast. BPM-1 can also be experienced as an ecstatic union with other people, with nature, with the entire universe, or with God. Unio Mystica. The experiential spectrum of BPM-1 also includes visions of heavens or paradises from the mythologies of various cultures. Conversely, there seems to be a deep connection between disturbances of embryonic life and psychotic states that involve paranoid perception and distortion of reality. Many prenatal disturbances involve chemical changes in the mother's body, toxicosis. This seems to explain why so many paranoid patients suspect that somebody is poisoning their food, that some venomous gases are being pumped into their house, or that a wicked scientist is exposing them to dangerous radiation. Experiences of these hostile influences are often accompanied by visions of various evil entities and demonic archetypal beings. Another source of paranoid feelings is the beginning phase of BPM-2. This is not surprising since the onset of delivery is a major and irreversible disturbance of the prenatal existence. Considering how unpleasant and confusing these situations must be for the fetus, it is not difficult to understand that the emerging memory of the onset of birth or of a serious intrauterine perturbation into the consciousness of an adult can cause feelings of all-pervading anxiety and vital threat. For obvious reasons, the source of this danger cannot be identified and remains unknown. The individual then tends to project these feelings on some threatening situation in the external world, on secret underground organizations, the Nazis, communists, Freemasons, Ku Klux Klan, or on some other potentially or actually dangerous human group, possibly even on extraterrestrial invaders. Reliving the onset of delivery often brings experiences of entering into the shamanic or mythological underworld. Fully developed forms of BPM-2 contribute the motifs of eternal damnation, despair, inhuman tortures, and diabolic ordeals to psychotic symptomatology. Many psychotic patients experience what seems like never-ending suffering in hell, or tortures that seem to be coming from some ingenious contraptions designed for that purpose. Psychoanalytic studies showed that the influencing machine, described by many psychotic patients as causing excruciating agony, represents the body of the bad mother. However, these authors failed to recognize that the dangerous and torturing maternal body belongs to the delivering mother, not to the nursing mother. Other psychotic themes related to BPM-2 are experiences of a meaningless, bizarre and absurd world of automata and the atmosphere of grotesque circus sideshows. A brilliant portrayal of these nightmarish experiences can be found in the biomechanoid art of the Swiss genius of fantastic realism, Hans-Rudi Giger. BPM-3 adds a rich array of experiences that represent various facets of this complex matrix to the clinical picture of psychotic states. The titanic aspect manifests in the form of unbearable tensions, powerful energy flows, clashes, and discharges. The corresponding imagery and ideation is related to violent scenes of wars, revolutions, and bloody massacres. These can often reach archetypal dimensions, and these scenes are portrayed on an enormous scale. A cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil, darkness and light, angels battling devils, titans challenging gods, or superheroes fighting mythological monsters. The archetype of the witch's Sabbath or black mass rituals, combining motifs of death, sex, aggression, and scatology, can also appear in the experiences of psychotic patients. The transition from BPM-3 to BPM-4 contributes sequences of psychospiritual death and rebirth, apocalyptic visions of destruction and recreation of the world, and the scenes of the judgment of the dead, or last judgment, to the spectrum of psychotic experiences. This can be accompanied by identification with Jesus or archetypal figures representing death and resurrection, and lead to ego inflation and messianic feelings. This is where fantasies and experiences of sacred marriage, hieros gamos, fathering a divine child or giving birth to it, belong. Experiences of divine epiphany, visions of the great mother goddess or identification with her, encounters with angelic beings and deities appearing in light, and a sense of salvation and redemption also belong to characteristic manifestations of BPM-4. At the time when I first suggested that much of psychotic symptomatology could be understood in terms of perinatal dynamics, I was not able to find any clinical studies supporting this hypothesis or even exploring this possibility. It was astonishing how little attention researchers had given to the possible relationship between psychoses and the trauma of birth. Today, half a century later, there exists important clinical evidence that prenatal disturbances and the trauma of birth play an important role in the genesis of psychoses. As a matter of fact, inadequate nourishment and viral infections during the mother's pregnancy and obstetric complications during birth, including long labors and oxygen deprivation, are among the few consistently reported risk factors for schizophrenia. Due to the strong influence of biological thinking in psychiatry, the interpretations of these data tend to favor the assumption that birth had caused some subtle brain damage undetectable by current diagnostic methods. Mainstream theoreticians and clinicians still fail to acknowledge the paramount role of birth and prenatal disturbances as a major psychotrauma. While the perinatal experiences described previously often represent a combination of biological memories of birth and archetypal motifs with corresponding themes, the phenomenology of psychotic states can also contain various transpersonal experiences in a pure form, without the mixture of biological perinatal elements. The most common of these are experiences of past life memories, of contact with extraterrestrials, and of encounters with various deities and demonic beings. Occasionally, individuals diagnosed as psychotic can also have very elevated spiritual experiences, such as identification with God, with the absolute, or with the metacosmic void. Many of these experiences have been reported by mystics, saints, prophets, and spiritual teachers of all ages. It is absurd, as we have seen earlier, to attribute all these experiences to some unknown pathological process in the brain or elsewhere in the body, which is a common practice in modern psychiatry. This naturally raises the question of the relationship between psychosis and mystical experience. I have so far used the terms psychosis and psychotic, as is common in academic psychiatry. As we will see in the next section, the observations and experiences from holotropic states suggest that the concept of psychosis has to be radically redefined. When we look at these experiences in the context of the large cartography of the psyche that is not limited to postnatal biography, but includes the perinatal and transpersonal domains, it becomes clear that the difference between mysticism and mental disorder is less in the nature and content of the experiences involved than in the attitude toward them, the individual's experiential style, the mode of interpretation, and the ability to integrate them. Joseph Campbell often used a quote in his lectures that captures this relationship. The psychotic drowns in the same waters in which the mystic swims with delight. My own reservations toward this otherwise very appropriate quote are related to the fact that the experiences of the mystics are often difficult and taxing, and not necessarily all delightful. But the mystic is capable of seeing these challenges in the larger context of a spiritual journey that has a deeper purpose and a desirable goal. This approach to psychoses has profound implications not only for theory, but also for therapy, and most importantly, for the course and outcome of these states. The observations from experiential therapy confirm the revolutionary ideas of the pioneers of an alternative understanding of psychosis: C.G. Jung, Roberto Assaggioli, Abraham Maslow, and John W. Perry, in far-reaching ways.